All right. The Nebraska Court of Appeals may all who come here be heard. May truth and justice be served by what we do here.
Thank you. Please be seated. Want to welcome you to the February session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. This is the morning panel. My name is David Arterburn. I'm pleased to be joined on my left by Judge Francie Reedman and on my right by Chief Judge Mike Pirtle. Again, this is the February session. We do want to advise all counsel that these proceedings are live streamed, so if there is any sensitive information, you should keep that in mind because this is live streamed and then recorded and available on the court website. So we have four cases this morning. We will take them in order. As your case is called, you may come and approach counsel table. I will again call the name of the case right before the argument for purposes of the live stream. So the first case is State versus Wyrick. And if I'm fracturing any names, whether it be of the attorneys or the parties, please feel free to correct me, counsel. So this is State versus Wyrick, and Mr. Meyerly.
Thank you, may I approach?
You may, and you may proceed.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Matthew Meyerly. I'm an attorney with the Lancaster County Public Defender's Office here in Lincoln. Our office was appointed to represent Mr. Wyrick on his direct appeal of a conviction for second-degree murder and use of a weapon to commit a felony. Our office was not trial counsel. I would ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Your Honor, we're asking the court to reverse Mr. Wyrick's conviction in this case on a number of bases that are set forth in the brief. We think that there were both some underlying errors at the trial court level, which were then compounded or at least interwoven with issues of ineffective assistance of counsel, which we think do support a remedy of vacating Mr. Wyrick's conviction, most particularly for the second-degree murder conviction. When the jury saw Exhibit number 33, and the court would have had an opportunity to review that video as well. What the jury would have seen, what the court has seen, is essentially a sudden quarrel. And I think that the witnesses, particularly the eyewitnesses in the neighborhood that day, were unanimous as to the nature of the altercation that occurred. What the jury saw first is Mr. Wyrick walking, and then ultimately Mr. Lane chasing Mr. Wyrick with this knife.
Well, doesn't something
actually transpose between those, like maybe the showing of a firearm and Mr. Wyrick saying something to him?
That was, as I understood the trial court record, what preceded the initial physical altercation.
Because there had been two altercations, right?
There were, and they were separated by a brief period of time. We think, actually, that that brief period of time bolsters the conclusion that Mr. Wyrick was acting in self-defense when Mr. Lane ended up chasing him with the knife. But Mr. Hirschfink, who was the first eyewitness, testified that he observed the two parties to be engaging. There was some testimony from Mr. Herrera that Mr. Wyrick had a firearm but never took it out of his pants or brandished it or threatened to use it on Mr. Lane in any way. It was essentially a verbal argument at that time that Mr. Lane then engaged in. Mr. Wyrick, the two engaged in that initial physical altercation. The two parties then separate. Mr. Lane goes back to his apartment. Mr. Wyrick is walking away. Mr. Wyrick was heard to make statements like, "I'm done," specifically to advise Mr. Lane that he was disengaging. And then what the jury would have seen in Exhibit 33 was, again, Mr. Lane chasing Mr. Wyrick with the knife, the two of them struggling over the knife. The witnesses, particularly Detective Agnew, as well as the others, could not conclusively say at what point the stabbing occurred, but we think that within the brief couple of seconds that that second altercation took place, that it really does establish a sudden quarrel between the two. Again, there was no evidence that we think can be seen in Exhibit 33 that Mr. Wyrick was acting with the intent to kill Mr. Lane.
Does Exhibit 33 support a jury's determination that Mr. Lane had fallen to the ground, was still standing and had the opportunity to walk away, but instead moved forward and thrust the knife into him?
I don't believe so, and I think that this is, again, sort of an issue that we think is compounded by the time period involved. What the jury sees is Mr. Lane sort of flung to the ground, the weight of Mr. Wyrick's propulsion sort of following him. I also think that it's important for the jury and for the fact finders to consider that Mr. Wyrick has already made numerous attempts to disengage and in fact has continued to be pursued. And so whether or not Mr. Wyrick would have had the opportunity in the few seconds of that last final confrontation to in fact remove himself, I think is pretty speculative.
But that was a question for the jury, right?
That would have been a question for the jury, certainly. We do think that the evidence with respect to the self-defense instruction does establish that Mr. Wyrick did not do anything to provoke the need or was justified in the use of deadly force to protect himself. And I don't know that that brief couple of seconds prior, if the court concludes that the stabbing did in fact occur while Mr. Lane was on the ground, I don't know that those couple of seconds necessarily contravene the self-defense instruction or conclusion.
The jury was given a manslaughter instruction.
They were given a manslaughter instruction. They were also given the self-defense instruction over the state's objection. We do think that perhaps, and this kind of bleeds into one of our ineffective assistance assignments, that the self-defense argument would have been bolstered had Mr. Wyrick been chosen to testify, been accurately advised by counsel about the necessity for that testimony in order for him to be able to directly provide the jury with evidence about his state of mind and what he believed necessary in those few brief final moments. We think that based on the totality of the evidence, that in fact it was unreasonable for counsel to advise Mr. Weyrich not to testify. And in fact, the jury or the state objecting to the self-defense instruction on the basis that there had been insufficient evidence adduced to support a self-defense claim is in fact further evidence of the fact that Mr. Weyrich probably should have testified in order to better flesh out that self-defense determination.
That's an easy call from the bleachers, isn't it?
Well, most of, I'm afraid so sometimes, but I do think that, again, Mr. Weyrich's testimony, both with respect to the motion to suppress and with respect to the trial testimony, the two main contentions that defense counsel was making at the trial court level, which is that Mr. Weyrich was not competent or that his waiver of Miranda was invalid because of his mental illnesses, as well as then his potential testimony to support a self-defense claim, both would have been bolstered had Mr. Weyrich been advised of the, I think, benefits of that testimony at the time. We do think, in addition, that there were a couple of evidentiary errors that the court made with respect to the motion in limine about evidence that Mr. Lane had ingested or had methamphetamine in his system. We think that, again, the totality of the trial in this case was presented, or the evidence did not provide the jury a full picture of the circumstances, which was that Mr. Lane, who had methamphetamine in his system, was aggressively pursuing Mr. Weyrich with the knife. We think that had the totality of that of the evidence been presented, had the jury had the opportunity to hear the totality of the evidence.
Was the defense counsel ready to produce an expert to say what the effect of methamphetamine would have on the situation?
I'm not certain. There was a pathologist who was retained by the defense. I don't know that his testimony would have gotten into the effect of methamphetamine at the time, but there was a pathologist who was retained by the defense, but who ultimately was not called at trial, and the record is silent as to the reason he was not called.
Without expert testimony, how is a jury to know to digest or understand what effect methamphetamine would have on the situation?
Well, I think that, one, the expert testimony would have been beneficial in establishing that. But two, I think that jurors are able to use their reason and common sense and understand the nature of methamphetamine. I see that I'm out of time. May I finish my thought? Thank you, Judge. I think that the jury, hearing that Mr. Lane had that methamphetamine in his system, would have been able to at least infer the possibility that he was the aggressor.
But couldn't the jury make that determination based upon the video evidence? I mean, Mr. Weyrich didn't know that Mr. Lane had methamphetamine in his system, so why is that important for the jury to know?
I think that it's important for the jury to know because it's, again, further evidence that could have been produced by defense counsel to sort of paint a fuller picture of the altercation itself and the positions of the two parties in that altercation. And so we are asking the court to reverse Mr. Weyrich's convictions on both counts. Thank you.
Any further questions?
No.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meyerly. And how much time did we take Mr. Meyerly over?
54, sir.
All right. Would you please add that to the appellee's time? right. All right, Mr. List, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellate state of Nebraska. Wyrick raises several assignments of error on appeal. I intend to focus primarily on the denial of his motion to suppress and the granting of the state's motion in limine. As far as the denial of Wyrick's motion to suppress, which pertained to the statements he made to police during his interview, the issue here, of course, is whether Wyrick validly waived his Miranda rights prior to making the statements in question. More specifically, the issue is whether the Miranda waiver was A, voluntary, and B, knowing and intelligent. We maintain that both requirements were satisfied here. As far as whether the Miranda waiver was voluntary, set forth in our brief, the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear in Colorado v. Conley that the inquiry is not whether the defendant's waiver was the product of a free choice, but rather whether there was improper government action that led to the waiver. In other words, coercive police activity is a necessary predicate to finding that the Miranda waiver was involuntary. In this case, as in Colorado v. Conley, the statements were not the product of, or the waiver was not the product of police coercion. He was advised of his Miranda rights, which he acknowledged and waived, and there was nothing coercive about the waiver or the circumstances of the interview itself. The fact that he had previously been found incompetent in a separate trial or a separate case did not mean that his Miranda waiver was involuntary in this case, because again, as Colorado v. Conley notes, the defendant's mental condition by itself and apart from government coercion should never dispose of the inquiry into constitutional voluntariness.
Does that go more to the issue of whether it was knowingly made?
Whether or not he was mentally incompetent, yes, it does. And that's the point I'm making here, is that at least on the voluntariness, on the voluntariness component, we have to have coercion. The mental issues alone won't get us there. And here we don't have coercion, so at least on the first component, in our view, there's nothing to see here. As far as the second component, whether the Miranda waiver was knowing and intelligent, as noted in our brief, the inquiry here is whether the defendant had the capacity to understand and act in response to the Miranda warnings given by the interrogating officer. The question is not whether the defendant had the capacity or the mental competence to stand trial, which is a separate and higher threshold. The question is simply whether the defendant had the capacity to understand and waive the Miranda rights. Here, as the record reflects, Mr. Wyrick had the capacity to do so. The video of the interview reflects that he was Mirandized at the outset of his interview, with him acknowledging his rights and agreeing to speak with the officers, after which he provided a detailed and coherent statement or explanation of the fight between he and Lane. He also asked the officers at one point during the interview if he was going to jail, which shows that he was aware of the potential consequences of the interview as well as the investigation.
Mr. List, at some point during the interview, Mr. Wyrick tells the police officers about being found incompetent, or he makes some statements about he's going to, I can't remember what.
Competency to stand trial. He's waiting for a bed.
Yeah, he's waiting for a bed at the regional center. That's what I was trying to think of. At that point, do the officers have any duty to flesh out more of what his competency level is before they proceed to continue with the interview?
I think if there had been more, especially if he's struggling up until that point and there are signs that maybe he's not fully aware of what's happening here, and then you hear that, I would say certainly, probably, in that circumstance, it should. Here, Detective Agnew, who was involved in the interview, said that they had not seen any signs of him having problems understanding what was going on. There's also no signs of impairment from drugs, alcohol, or mental health issues. Based on my review of that video, I certainly didn't either. There was nothing at all at any point in time that stood out as him having trouble grasping reality or what was happening during this interview. So given the circumstances here, I would say no. They did go into it, and it's not like when he said that, they just flat out didn't ask any questions and said, well, shut up about that. We don't want to hear anything, with respect to this, mental competence issues you have going on. I mean, he asked, well, okay, what's going on with that? And, okay, are you on any medications? Does that help? Is that taking care of that? And he said, yeah, to all that. And then, like I said, it was, when you look at everything from beginning to end, the conversation was completely coherent. There was no indication that he didn't have any awareness as to what was going on, whether it was discussing what had happened or his mental health issues. So I guess to respond to your question, I think they did address it to some extent, maybe not as much as possible, but they did respond and address it when he brought that up. And given that, along with all the other circumstances, I don't think that they needed to do anything more in this case. So we would maintain that on the record before us, the Miranda waiver was both voluntary as well as intelligent and knowing. Just briefly, for the sake of argument, we would maintain that if this court were to find that there was any error with the denial of the motion to suppress and the admission of the statements, we would maintain that any error here is harmless. I'm not going to rehash the harmless error argument set forth in our brief, but we would maintain that it was harmless in this case.
Mr. Liss, can you address, what do you think the best evidence is that the jury would have relied upon to negate a sudden quarrel?
To negate a sudden quarrel?
Yeah, I mean, they obviously found it wasn't upon sudden quarrel because of the conviction that they, or the right. verdict that they handed down. So what's the best evidence that they could have relied upon to reach that determination?
There's probably sort of three points or main points that I assume the trier of fact would have honed in on there. The first one being that Mr. Wyrick, by all appearances, started this whole thing when he walked up and you know, lifted his shirt and flashed his waistband to Mr. Lane. Second one would probably be that, you know, after Lane went inside and Wyrick left, he obviously left the scene for a period of time, but he could have done more to leave. But instead he stayed in the area, and you know, I know it shows the video shows him trying to get into a building and you know, disengage, but nonetheless, he didn't leave. He still stayed around, and when Lane came back down the sidewalk, he grabs rocks and sort of re-engages. And then the third and final point is probably, and perhaps the most important point, is, you know, at the very tail end of that fight, you know, I think based on the evidence, and certainly my review of the video, Wyrick could have gotten away from this. And they, granted, they were tussling toward the very end there, but and it was certainly the state's theory of the case here was that, you know, once he had Mr. Lane down on the ground, that Wyrick could have gotten away without stabbing him.
But even after he stabs him, Mr. Lane stands up and still moves forward towards him. I mean, I guess, question of fact, maybe, for
well,
the jury
ultimately.
In determining whether or not Mr. Wyrick thought he could get away.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think that's the beginning and the end of the analysis, is that this was a question of fact for the trier of fact. They were properly instructed on, you know, both sudden quarrel and self-defense, and they found that it was neither. So, you know, as far as where we're at now on appeal, you know, that's, in my assessment, just a matter of weight and credibility evidence, which we don't re-weigh. But that's my best assessment to answer your question as to why I think they probably would have found that sudden quarrel didn't apply here. Just briefly, if there are no further questions on sufficiency or the motion to suppress, I'll just briefly address the granting of the state's motion in limine regarding the victim having drugs in the system. First and foremost, we maintain this issue is not preserved for appeal, given that when this evidence was excluded at trial, the defense didn't make an offer of proof to establish that Jeremy Lane had drugs in his system, let alone what substances they were and what behaviors may have been caused by those substances. To the extent this claim is alternatively raised as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim and is properly before this court in that regard, the state maintains that Wyrick cannot show prejudice on this claim because even if this evidence had been adduced, it really wouldn't have changed anything at trial. The surveillance footage itself showed how the fight started, and the surveillance footage as well as eyewitness testimony established what transpired during the fight. The fact that Lane may have had drugs in his system really wouldn't have changed any of that evidence, especially when, as the state noted during the hearing on this motion in limine, the presence of drugs in a person's system does not generally, cannot establish if the person was actually under influence of those drugs or to what extent. Plus, as Judge Rubin noted, there was no evidence in this case, nor has there been any allegation, that Mr. Wyrick even knew Mr. Lane had drugs in his system. So we maintain there's not a reasonable probability that the result of the trial would have been different if this evidence could have and had been adduced at trial.
Can you address, I think it was Exhibit 34 that had the arms drawn in on the video? I know it was offered and received, well, for demonstrative purposes, but no limiting instruction was requested. Can you address the ineffective assistance of counsel potentially on the absence of a limiting instruction?
Well, the ineffective assistance claim, as assigned and argued, I think there's two components to it. Number one, the trial counsel was ineffective for not objecting on Daubert grounds to this coming in conjunction with the state's witness's testimony.
But they did have a Daubert hearing, essentially, right, in the midst of trial on that?
Yeah, and there was, as I read the record, there was a Daubert objection. And so, at least on that component of the claim, we would submit the record refutes it. As far as the other component of the claim, it was that, I'm trying to recall, there were so many ineffective claims. Oh, with respect to it being lack of limiting instruction, given that it came in as a demonstrative exhibit, they cite Pangborn, and my understanding of Pangborn is that a limiting instruction is going to be required for demonstrative exhibits if they're going back to the jury to be considered. But that didn't happen in this case. So we would submit that a limiting instruction was not required. And then, we also argued in brief, and I would maintain that they can't show prejudice in this claim because really what happened with respect to this exhibit, when I watched it, didn't necessarily add anything beyond what the original surveillance videos did anyway. I didn't really see that there was much value into this. The state must have thought there was some because they adduced this evidence. But
and used it in closing.
Right. I mean, they did use it, absolutely. The record's clear on that. But I guess if I'm sitting there as a trier of fact, when I watched it, I didn't seem to do much. It didn't seem to add much. And the state's witness who put this together, he himself acknowledged that even with the video, he couldn't say definitively where Mr. Weirich's arms or hands were at least at the final moments when it would have been critical, which is what the state was hoping to use this for. So I guess we would submit that to whatever extent there could have even been deficient performance here, Mr. Weirich can't show prejudice on this claim. I'm out of time.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much. The case will be deemed submitted. And the parties are excused. Thank you very much. I believe we used all Mr. Meyerly's time, didn't we?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You're excused. All right. The